From Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio, we present David Lodge's essay, The Death of Diana, as read by Jim Broadbent. Twenty years ago, the world woke up to this news.
The Interior Minister from Paris for a short time, and now there is confirmation that Diana, Princess of Wales, has died. She died at 4 a.m. after going into cardiac arrest. That, according to doctors at the hospital in Paris, Diana, Princess of Wales.
Novelist and, at the time, Professor of English Literature at the University of Birmingham, David Lodge, wrote the following essay to try to understand the nation's reaction to the death of Diana. It was read for the RNIB Talking Book Service by Jim Broadbent.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm reading David Lodge's The Death of Diana for the Talking Book Service. This is an edited version of an essay written 2 or 3 weeks after the death of Princess Diana on August the 31st, 1997. I wrote it on spec, mainly because I wanted to record my own impressions of and thoughts about the event and its aftermath while they were still fresh in my mind. I vaguely hoped to place it in an American or foreign journal, but by the time it was finished, the international press was sated with articles on this subject, and I soon abandoned the attempt. Later, I made some use of the material in a stage play and novella entitled Home Truths. I've shortened the original essay considerably, but have left its reflections as they were expressed in September 1997. I would not substantially revise them in the light of subsequent developments and revelations. I heard the news relatively late, because we don't listen to the radio at home in the mornings, and there was nothing about it in the Sunday papers delivered to our provincial doorstep, printed the night before. I was in the kitchen making mid-morning coffee, timed for the return of my wife from attending Mass at our parish church. Usually I accompany her, but on this occasion I hadn't. Mary came in at about 10:30, frowning. "Have you heard that Princess Diana has died?" she said. There were prayers for her at Mass. I think I said, "Oh, no," something like that anyway. I remember feeling an unexpectedly sharp pang of real regret, quite different from what one usually feels about the death of a well-known but remote public figure. "How?" was my first question. Mary didn't know. She hadn't lingered at the church because we were going out. We turned on the television and acquainted ourselves with the basic facts about the accident in Paris. We watched and listened to the Prime Minister speaking live outside his parish church in County Durham. He looked genuinely shocked and grief-stricken. The reporters and presenters on TV also seemed exceptionally moved by what they were reporting, real feeling threatening to overwhelm their professionalism. Martin Lewis's voice broke once, and it seemed to me that his cheeks were wet. This struck me as extraordinary and unprecedented. But there didn't seem to be any immediate prospect of additional hard news, only speculation and hand-wringing. We decided to go ahead with our expedition, but we talked over the tragedy in the car and during the rest of the outing. Again and again one's thoughts kept reverting to it. My predominant reaction, after that initial surprising pang of personal regret, the simple wish that it hadn't happened, was to reflect on the extraordinarily literary quality of the manner and timing of Diana's death. No novelist or scriptwriter could have improved on its ironies and symmetries. The legendary princess cut down in her prime, together with the man recently acknowledged as the love of her life, apparently hounded to death by the lackeys of the very media which had made her famous. The day was dark and rainy, and we drove home in the early afternoon in a ferocious thunderstorm, as if nature was doing its best to encourage the pathetic fallacy. I thought of Julius Caesar. "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes." As soon as we got indoors, I switched on the television, just in time to see Prince Charles arriving at the Paris hospital with Diana's two shocked-looking sisters. From then onwards, it was hard to keep away from the television. I'd never met the princess, or seen her in the flesh. I'd never thought about her unless she was prominently in the news, which admittedly was quite often, especially over the last few weeks. And I had always regarded her as a flawed human being, more sinned against than sinning, certainly, but at least partly responsible for her own misfortunes, and excessively concerned with her own public image. And yet I felt that a light had gone out of the world. I was not alone. It soon became clear that the whole nation, or a very large part of it, was swamped by an extraordinarily powerful tidal wave of emotion, in which grief predominated. Diana's death and the events of the week following surely constituted one of the most remarkable public dramas of the century. A collective catharsis that climaxed at the funeral. Especially at that moment, beyond the daring of any scriptwriter's imagination, when applause on the streets of London for Earl Spencer's broadcast eulogy, with its implicit criticism of the royal family, surged through the open doors of the Abbey and was taken up by the congregation. In Hyde Park, more than 100,000 people who were watching the funeral service on giant TV screens, many in tears, leapt to their feet and clapped their hands. A friend of mine who was present said it was an electrifying experience. "I understood for the first time the nature of a revolutionary crowd," he said. "If somebody had told us to march against Buckingham Palace, we would have marched." But those commentators who dismissed the whole thing as a product of mass hysteria or media manipulation seemed to me to have completely misread it. It was authentic. Literally millions of blossoms, weighing some 10,000 tons in all, it is estimated, have been gathered and laid upon the ground in Diana's memory. A charitable fund opened in her name has already attracted over £100 million in donations. Her place of burial is expected to become a popular shrine. There is talk of constructing a pilgrimage walk through the London parks, connecting landmarks associated with her life. Hard-bitten journalists have apologised in print for the snide articles they wrote about her in the past. My wife, summarising one such mea culpa to me at breakfast, suddenly burst into tears, surprising herself as much as me. Three Scottish professional footballers, a social group not renowned for emotional sensitivity, flatly refused to play for their country in an international match scheduled for the day of Diana's funeral, and forced the Scottish Football Association to change the date of the fixture. My tennis club closed for the morning of the funeral, but reopened at 2 p.m. The organiser of social tennis, a down-to-earth 40-something Birmingham businessman, sent a message that he was too upset to attend. A man told a national phone-in radio programme that he had lost his wife through cancer last April. They had been happily married for 44 years and he loved her dearly, but he had shed more tears for Diana than for his wife. These are just a few representative facts and anecdotes culled from thousands. Whether the effects of Diana's death proved to be lasting or ephemeral, the public and private reaction to it, not only in Britain but around the world, was still extraordinary. And the question remains, why? Many theories have been advanced in the last few weeks. None of them can explain the phenomenon alone, but perhaps if we put them together they begin to suggest an answer to the question. We can list them as versions of Diana and interpretations of her meaning. 1. The star. She was a star. The word was used again and again in the immediate aftermath of her death. Once restricted to the film industry, it is now applied to celebrities of all kinds. In the secularised modern world, stars are the nearest thing we have to the pagan deities of the classical age, after one of whom Diana herself was named. Stars are like us, and sometimes they visit our mundane world and touch our lives, but mostly they inhabit another plane of existence, a world of luxury, glamour, mobility and excess, which we can only glimpse through the media. Nobody is born a star, but some achieve stardom and some have it thrust upon them. Diana belonged to the latter category. What propelled her from obscurity to fame was, of course, her engagement and marriage to the heir to the British throne. It was, as people said at the time, a fairy tale wedding, a modern Cinderella story. Her good fortune seemed to demonstrate that the wish fulfillment of romance need not be confined to the world of fiction. It could actually happen. In fact, Diana belonged to a rich and aristocratic family and had had the conventional upbringing of a girl of her class. But at the time of her engagement, she seemed like the girl next door, pretty, shy, unaffected and unpretentious, earning her living in a humble job, assistant at a creche, and sharing a flat with other working girls. She was seen as a catalyst that would modernise and humanise the monarchy. As we all know, that hope was dashed, and the fairy tale turned into something more melodramatic and more ironic, the royal soap opera. It is important to remember, amid the posthumous adulation she is receiving, that public opinion was always divided about Diana's part in the deterioration and collapse of her marriage to Charles and about her behaviour after they separated and divorced. If she had lived to marry her Dodi, she would undoubtedly have attracted a good deal of criticism for so doing. Controversy didn't make her any less of a star, on the contrary. But it was only in death that she achieved apotheosis, that immortal stardom which very few attain, e.g. Marilyn Monroe, Eva Peron, Elvis Presley, and none of them so quickly or on the same global scale. Diana's death instantly edited out all her faults and follies in public consciousness. It was only her virtues, her good works, her suffering and her beauty that were remembered. In the days following her death, we were frequently told that she had been the most famous woman in the world, and it seemed obviously true, but I can't recall anyone saying it before her death. 2. The icon. It is hardly necessary to state that Diana would never have achieved her quasi-mythical status if she hadn't been beautiful. But it is worth considering what kind of beauty it was, and how it was mediated. It was not flawless. Her nose, for instance, was too long and the wrong shape for classical perfection. But it was highly photogenic. In the days following her death, we were reminded again and again of the stunning visual impact of her appearance in photographs and on film. To use a film industry cliché, the camera loved her. While, as an article in an independent newspaper shrewdly observed, portrait painters generally failed to convey any sense of her exceptional physical presence. She could have been a model, she had the tall, lissom figure for it, and the natural grace of movement, and a passion for clothes. Though she suffered from and resented the attentions of the paparazzi, she clearly enjoyed posing for the camera on her own terms. Cynics will say that Diana's fame was precisely an illusion, a trick performed by the media, who exploited her iconic potential for their own materialistic ends, and that the demonstration of public grief at her death was also largely generated and manipulated by the media. Undoubtedly, the myth of Diana both before and after her death would never have developed as it did before the age of the mass media. It was through the media that she imprinted her image on our consciousness more deeply than we realised until she was dead. But the media are such an all-pervasive part of modern life that it is vain to suppose we can find some other, more authentic ground for public, collective experience. Although there was certainly something contagious about the grieving for Diana, which television in particular encouraged, there was nothing hysterical about the behaviour of the people who queued to write in the books of condolence or lined the streets of Diana's funeral route. And the saturation coverage of the event does not explain, or explain away, the small private pang of sorrow which most people felt when they first heard the news.
You're listening to the essay The Death of Diana by David Lodge, read exclusively for the RNIB Talking Book Service by Jim Broadbent, and we'll have more in a moment.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. To join, telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk. RNIB is a membership organisation. To join, visit rnib.org.uk/membership.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
And now a return to Jim Broadbent, reading David Lodge's essay, The Death of Diana.
Three, the Madonna of the Charities. The media, which were so prurently fascinated by Diana's marital and emotional problems in life, have focused since her death on her devotion to her two sons and on her work for charity and good causes like the abolition of anti-personnel mines. This is all part of the ongoing secular canonisation of Diana, against which the Earl Spencer gently warned in his funeral address, when he pointed out that her high-profile charitable work was in part an effort to overcome a lack of self-esteem. This is not to say that it was simply a calculated polishing of her public image. On the contrary, it is clear that she often did good by stealth, and that when she did it publicly, she genuinely saw this as a way of turning her media celebrity to positive account. However, it was, again, her beauty, her effortless physical grace, which made her such a potent figure in the fundraising, consciousness-raising business. The images we saw replayed and reprinted again and again in the last week or so, of Diana touching an AIDS patient, of Diana walking through a minefield, and above all of Diana hugging, cradling and holding on her lap children and infants suffering from all kinds of dreadful disease, mutilation and malnutrition, were intensely moving precisely because she never seemed to be straining for effect. She didn't need to. 4. The culture heroine. I first encountered this term in Richard Chase's classic 1948 essay, The Brontes, or Myth Domesticated. Rochester and Heathcliff are portrayed as being at once godlike and satanic. In them, the universal enemies may be set at war by a culture heroine. Then if the devil is overcome, a higher state of society will have been achieved. The tyrannical father god will have been displaced. Chase argued that the Bronte sisters, or their fictional heroines, ultimately backed away from the achievement of this mission, settling for domesticity, bourgeois marriage and Christian orthodoxy. But he gave them credit for challenging their patriarchal society in such ambitious terms, thus anticipating much later feminist criticism. Modern feminist writers have been ambivalent about Diana, especially Diana the star, Diana the icon, for obvious reasons. But many women in Britain today and in other countries have seen her struggle for personal fulfilment against the restrictions imposed on her by a monarchy whose values are essentially patriarchal, even though the present monarch is a queen, and her experience of emotional neglect, marital breakdown, depression, eating disorders and single parenthood as an epic version of their own trials and tribulations. The key to the astonishing reaction to Diana's death, according to the psychiatrist Oliver James, writing in The Independent, was the way that the agonies of her particular plotline mirrored the real suffering of the populace, particularly women and young people. Above all, the scale of the reaction is caused by a massive undercurrent of misery that afflicts women throughout the developed world today and for which Diana's death is a conduit. It is crucial to this interpretation that Diana was killed at the very moment when she seemed to have triumphed over the repressive patriarchal forces ranged against her. If she had married Dodi and spent the rest of her life swanning happily about the world in luxury yachts and private planes from one exclusive fleshpot to another, she would have failed as a culture heroine even more spectacularly than Chase thought the Bronte heroines failed. This is not merely a feminist issue. Much has been read by political commentators into the mass identification with Diana in her death by people of all races, creeds, classes and region in British society, and their success in forcing a full-scale ceremony of public mourning upon a reluctant royal family. It has been dubbed the Floral Revolution by Martin Jakes, formerly editor of Marxism Today. Jakes was one of the first British Marxist intellectuals to recognise that the Thatcher era had banished old-fashioned socialism from British political life for good, and that New Labour's version of a market economy, humanised by a corporate state, was the left's best hope for the future. Connections have been drawn between Tony Blair's landslide victory last May and the surge of popular feeling over the death of Diana, reinforced by the Prime Minister's faultless handling of the latter event, publicly and behind the scenes. The general election result and the popular reaction to Diana's death were both unprecedented and totally unexpected in scale, and both were motivated by sentiment rather than ideology. The occurrence of two such massive convulsions in such a short space of time has prompted speculation that British society really has changed, that the old patriarchal code of the stiff upper lip, emotional reticence, respect for authority, tradition and social precedence, which used to characterise us as a nation, has gone forever, along with the cynicism, individualism and greed which flourished in the Thatcher years, to be replaced by a much more open, flexible and compassionate and feminised ethos. Well, we shall see. 5. The victim. The first instinctive reaction to Diana's death was to see her as the victim of a degenerate press, and this remains an important element in the more complex web of emotion and interpretation that now surrounds the event. It would have been deeply satisfying to the general public if early reports that the paparazzi directly caused the fatal accident by buzzing her car on their motorcycles had been confirmed. It now seems clear that the main cause was that the driver, Henri Paul, was drunk and using pharmaceutical drugs prescribed for depression and alcoholism, and driving the vehicle at reckless speed. Indirectly, however, the paparazzi were responsible for the tragedy. Their relentless pursuit of Diana and Dodi, which had been going on for weeks, had reached a pitch of hysteria on both sides by the day of the fatal crash. An article in the London Sunday Times for the 7th of September, which reconstructed the last day of Diana and Dodi in meticulous detail, revealed that the couple changed their plans several times in a vain effort to throw the photographers off their trail. And the well-attested reports of the paparazzi clustered round the crushed Mercedes like carrion crows, shooting photos of the dead and dying occupants through the windows instead of giving assistance, aroused widespread anger and disgust. Here, at the scene of her death, the various images of Diana, the divinity, the icon, the culture heroine, the victim, were violently forced together. Earl Spencer noted in his tribute the irony that his sister, named after the goddess of hunting, was herself the most hunted of human beings. But another legend associated with the goddess, the story of Actaeon surprising her bathing, portrays her as the object of male voyeurism. The paparazzi, toting their gross telescopic lenses like swollen phalluses, are the very embodiment of commercialised voyeurism. There have been calls for new laws and codes of practice to restrict their activities and promises by contrite editors not to use their services in the future. But I fear this will be the most transitory effect of Diana's death. 6. The departed soul. If Richard Dawkins has publicly commented on the death of Diana and its aftermath, I missed it. I would dearly like to know what he, or Daniel Dennett, or any other of our fashionable neo-Darwinian scientists and philosophers made of it. They must be exasperated. For years they have been telling us in well-written, well-argued, well-researched books and articles and lectures and TV documentaries that there is no such thing as the immortal soul, no ghost in the machine, that individual self-consciousness is a product of the brain capacity we happen to have surplus to our evolutionary requirements and ceases when our brain activity ceases, that human beings are disposable vehicles for the transmission of genes, the only true immortals. Then a beautiful young woman dies in a car crash, and all over the world people are consumed with grief and seek consolation in behaviour that, however vulgar and improvised, has its roots in religious ritual and language and assumes the immortality of the individual soul. Anyone who had stood up in Hyde Park on Saturday the 6th of September and declared that the person called Diana, Princess of Wales, was extinguished utterly and forever would have been seriously endangering their health. "Diana, we love you," read a banner held up during the minute silence at an international football match between England and Moldova 10 days after her death. Not loved, but love. Diana lives. But is this a manifestation of unsuspected reservoirs of faith or a release of suppressed anxiety and dread? Britain today is a largely secular country with a small and diminishing number of regular churchgoers. And among the latter, many, like myself, unwilling to sever their links with that long and rich tradition of scripture, liturgy and ethical discourse which has contributed so much to human civilization, will readily admit that for them it only makes a kind of metaphorical sense, expressing a yearning for, rather than a belief in, transcendence. The scientific materialists are much more confident and more plausible. We fear they may be right. Science has not deprived us of awe and wonder at the nature of the universe, quite the contrary. But it has made the idea of a personal God who intervenes in human history and numbers every hair of our individual heads desperately difficult to believe for all except fundamentalists. Immortality seems impossible, but extinction seems unbearable. That is the metaphysical double bind in which we find ourselves. The man or woman in the street does not perhaps reflect on these matters in such abstract terms, but the same unresolved contradiction gnaws away at their peace of mind as they pursue the materialistic good life which capitalism and modern technology have made increasingly accessible. We all live in secret fear of the positive biopsy, the unsurvivable air crash, the fatal road accident that interrupts and renders irrelevant our quotidian desires, anxieties and satisfactions. When we hear about such things happening to strangers or read about them in the newspapers or see them on the TV news, our compassion is mingled with relief that the tragedy didn't happen to us or anyone near and dear to us, and with the dread knowledge that one day it will, in one form or another. We quickly suppress these intimations of mortality and get on with our lives. But when the tragedy happens to a star, a goddess, an icon, a culture heroine, a figure uniquely loaded with meanings for a vast number of people, who seem to move on a different plane from ordinary mortals but succumb to the most banal and unnecessary of violent deaths, then it is not surprising if all that repressed emotion should erupt in an explosion of collective grief and quasi-religious feeling. The man who wept more for Diana than for his wife was perhaps only weeping deferred tears for his spouse, and proleptic tears for his own inevitable end. Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Thus begins Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem, Spring and Fall, addressed to a young child moved to tears by the sad beauty of the autumn leaves. It ends, "It is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for." In the last analysis, it was not Diana, but ourselves that we mourned for.
On the 20th anniversary of the death of Diana, that was David Lodge's essay entitled The Death of Diana, and it was read for the RNIB Talking Book Service by Jim Broadbent.